My fellow speakers, ladies and gentlemen, in a quest to teach about Afro-American culture, most teachers, influenced by our traditional history, must actively seek ways to demythologize their thinking. This traditional history, which has been a bulwark of our prevailing system of racism in this country, has been allowed to flourish in our academic institutions. Only a short 5 years ago, maybe even less than that, most universities were not sponsoring conferences such as this one. In fact, they were uninterested and insensitive to the absolute necessity for such dialogue. We have no problem, most representatives of agencies such as my own Illinois Commission on Human Relations would be told. And this oft-repeated phrase could be heard from such persons as public and parochial school administrators, history scholars and their professors, social science teachers, professors of education, and public and private university and college administrators. I don't believe I've left anyone out. I recall about 8 years ago, a history professor telling me that Negro history was emotional, and anything simply emotional is not scholarly. It became obvious to me that the endemic nature of racism in this country has created a society with a disease so common that no one considers a cure. Probably the doctors are also inflicted, so where do we turn for a remedy? Most educators who tend to ignore the cultural contributions of Afro-Americans found yet another excuse when they imposed the term culturally deprived on millions of black and white children of the poor. Imagine these educators' dismay, however, when some of these same students whom they supposed were suffering from that malady called cultural deprivation began to demand courses in what? Afro-American culture and history. The task of learning how to teach the creative contributions of Afro-Americans becomes most difficult in a society which has created the impression that black people have no history worthy of study. It becomes crucial then to understand the historical perspectives on racism, the topic, of course, of this conference. It becomes crucial then to reveal the wasted years devoted to proving the Sambo image of the American Negro. Professor Melvin Drimmer of Spelman College recently edited an excellent and essential compilation that I certainly would recommend to you teachers, entitled Black History. And in this book, he states that racist historiography could gain such scholarly recognition must remain an indictment of the American historical profession. Moreover, so much time and effort were needed to overturn the Phillips School that historians were prevented from getting on with the work of studying other phases of Negro history. Possibly this is fitting for a society which has made a virtue of waste. It's true, the hour is late to do as Professor Drimmer suggests, get on with the work of studying other phases of Negro history. Black students, in fact, have created the pressure necessary to change these educational institutions. Their determined allegiance to the dignity and beauty of blackness must find its reflection in the curriculum of our schools and universities, and most particularly in a course in Afro-American culture. But members of our profession, primarily whites and middle class, will have to learn to develop an aesthetic appreciation for the lore of black folk and an understanding and a sensitivity to the black experience in America. John Oliver Killens, a black novelist warns us, just as surely as east is east and west is west, there is a black psyche in America and there is a white one. And the sooner we face up to this social and cultural reality, the sooner the twain shall meet. Our emotional chemistry is very different from yours in many instances. Your joy is very often our anger, and your despair our fervent hope. Most of us came here in chains, and most of you came here to escape your chains. Your freedom was our slavery, and therein lies the bitter difference in the way we look at life. The words of a black novelist. We are, what we need are new insights into the nature of slavery. Insights which would allow us to share the human reactions of the slaves to their condition. A course in Afro-American culture must therefore be based in the slave era, with the imprint of African culture upon America's forced immigrants clearly visible. Provisions must be made to do this, however, without evoking solely the familiar figures of the trusted house servants, so aptly described by novelist Killens when he said, weeping and moaning over little pure as the driven snow Missy Ann, who had just sneezed, while Mammy's own young'un was dying of double pneumonia, unattended, down in the cabins. White America created the myth of the contented slave and the wretched freedman, and thus destroyed for nearly a century any possibility of seriously teaching about Afro-American culture. The American mythmakers include most decisively those who record and interpret our country's past. These historians have reinforced the popular misconceptions most Americans have held regarding the Negro. Professor Auric B. Phillips dominated the interpretation of slavery for over a generation. Although a Southerner by birth, we all know he taught at the University of Michigan, a Northern institution. In his book, American Negro Slavery, written in 1918, he paraded his racism by viewing the institution of slavery as necessary for the Negroes, since they were, after all, in a foreign land and slowly changing from barbarism to civilization. Phillips, of course, trained many students who would profess his teachings across the nation from their various towers of learning. Ultimately, his influence pervaded the world of school teachers and their students, since these racist views have been incorporated into our American history textbooks until the present day of merely initial changes on the part of publishing companies. The popularity of Stanley Elkin's treatment of slavery at the turn of this decade did not help to overcome the effects of Phillips' influence. Elkin's, it is true, offered an indictment of slavery, but maintained a Sambo image of the Negro, contending that his personality was destroyed. Elkin's dependent, docile, loyal, lazy, and humble child of slavery's days sounds like the characterizations offered by white novelists both before and after the Civil War. Sterling Brown, in discussing the oversimplified characterization of the slave, cites as an example one novel entitled Life at the South or Uncle Tom's Cabin as It Is, written in 1852. The book concludes with Tom returning home to the South, of course, disillusioned with freedom. Brown quotes the following line from Smith's book, "And if the reader shall chance to travel the high road as it winds up the valley of the Shenandoah above Winchester, he will find no slave more contented than Uncle Tom." Professor Brown, in his unique style, responded, "A tall, tall order. Carry me back to old Virginia. They'd have to carry him back to get him there." And that was what a Negro like Frederick Douglass thought. And this opinion was certainly shared by other stout-hearted fugitives like Martin Delaney, David Ruggles, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, and William Wells Brown. John Killens again, in discussing also this myth of the faithful slave, states, "The master must always make himself believe in the undying love of his slave. This is why white America put words in the black man's mouth and bade him sing such improbable lyrics as, all de dockies am a-weepin', mouses in de cold, cold ground." Teachers subjected to such outstanding stereotypical treatments of the slave personality, compounded by the cultural deprivation syndrome, must realize these handicaps and seek new sources and listen to new voices, in most cases, black voices. The young Du Bois wrote a little book 65 years ago in order that men may listen to the strivings in the souls of black folk. From the Souls of Black Folk, an essay entitled Of Our Spiritual Strivings, Du Bois wrote the following in 1903. "It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, the sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideas in one dark body whose dogged strength keeps it from being torn asunder. The history of the American Negro is the history of this strife. He would not bleach his Negro soul in a flood of white Americanism, for he knows that Negro blood has a message for the world. This, then, is the end of his striving, to be a co-worker in the kingdom of culture, to escape both death and isolation. Throughout history, the powers of single black men flash here and there like falling stars and die sometimes before the world has rightly gauged their brightness. But we white Americans must remember that we must be taught to listen to the strivings in the souls of black folk. And this teaching must begin with the lore of the Negro revisited, again in the words of Du Bois 65 years ago. There are today no truer exponents of the pure human spirit of the Declaration of Independence than the American Negroes. There is no true American music but the wild, sweet melodies of the Negro slave. The American fairy tales and folklore are Indian and African. And all in all, we black men seem the sole oasis of simple faith and reverence in a dusty desert of dollars and smartness. Will America be poorer if she replaced her brutal, diseptic blundering with determined Negro humility, or her coarse and cruel wit with a loving, jovial good humor, or her vulgar music for the soul of the sorrow songs? James Weldon Johnson, a more well-known star whose brightness has not been rightly gauged, eulogized the creators of Du Bois' sorrow songs when he wrote the first stanza to this poem. O black and unknown bards of long ago, how came your lips to touch the sacred fire? How in your darkness did you come to know the power and beauty of the minstrel's lyre? Who first from midst his bonds lifted his eyes? Who first from out the still watch, lone and long, feeling the ancient faith of prophets rise within his dark-kept soul, burst into song? Sterling Brown, who did more individually to motivate my study of Afro-American culture than all the institutions I've attended, maintains that we must not only revise the myth of the spirituals as proof of the slave's contentment, but suggests many far-reaching insights into the true folk nature of the spirituals. Neither European nor African, but partaking of elements of both, the result is a new kind of music, certainly not mere imitation, but more creative and original than any other American music. Black people, furthermore, created a meaningful poetry when they revised the lines of many of the white spirituals. Let me give you an example. A white spiritual: to hide yourself in the mountaintop, to hide yourself from God. The black version: went down to the rocks to hide my face. The rocks cried out, no hiding place. Our revised study of slavery reveals that the spirituals would not blatantly speak of escape, but would certainly do so indirectly. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. They have, therefore, not only double meanings, but represent a tough life here on earth. Didn't my Lord deliver Daniel? And why not every man? By and by, I'm going to lay down this heavy load. The telling of tales was a custom brought from Africa by her folk brought involuntarily. The fables of Aesop, those African tales we were all taught to love, but certainly not to love as a creative contribution of black folk, demonstrate the importance of folklore in the old world. The slave owner knew the danger of most African survivals, but considered the telling of simple animal tales certainly a harmless pastime. Arna Bontemps and Langston Hughes, in their book of Negro Folklore, state that the folklores of these Negro slaves were actually projections of personal experiences and hopes, and defeats in terms of symbols appears to have gone unnoticed. The American Negro slave, adopting Br'er Rabbit as a hero, represented him as the most frightened and helpless of creatures. No hero animals in Africa or elsewhere were so completely lacking in strength. But the slaves took pains to give Br'er Rabbit other significant qualities. He became in their stories by turn a practical joker, a braggart, a wit, a glutton, a ladies' man, and a trickster. But his essential characteristic was his ability to get the better of bigger and stronger animals. To the slave in his condition, the theme of weakness overcoming strength through cunning proved endlessly fascinating. Also satisfying, for related reasons, were accounts of the defeat, if not the destruction, of the powerful Br'er Wolf, the stupid Br'er Bear, and the sly Br'er Fox. Variations on these themes permitted the storytellers to invest Br'er Squirrel, Sister Goose, Br'er Rooster, Br'er Alligator, and the rest with traits equally recognizable, equally amusing, and equally instructive. Referring to authors who helped establish the plantation tradition, Sterling Brown tells us that although Joel Chandler Harris captured some of the world's best folk literature through these Br'er Rabbit tales, they are, he reminds us, not genuinely folk, that is, of the folk, by the folk, to the folk, and for the folk. But we must remember they were told by an old uncle to entertain a little white boy. He suggests, on the other hand, that Charles Waddell Chestnut's volume of folk tales, The Conjure Woman, written in 1899, contains no nonsense about the good old days on the plantation. But, after all, Mr. Chestnut was Afro-American. Not only do we need a new and fresh approach to the folk songs, the animal tales, and rhymes, but the memories of slavery from the perspective of the enslaved, as opposed, that is, to the familiar story of the enslaver, must become a part of the teaching of American and Afro-American culture. Margaret Just Butcher, in her book The Negro in American Culture, states that slavery, moreover, planted the Negro deep in the subsoil of American life and made him culturally a basic American. Slave narratives, I might suggest, could include such books as The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass. I use this book to have my black students combine the lyrical phrases of Frederick Douglass into a magnificent work of prose, a worthy task for our black students. Other relevant sources could include Lay My Burden Down, A Folk History of Slavery by Botkin, The Journal of Charlotte Fortin, A Free Negro in the Slave Era, A Documentary History of the Negro People in the United States by Herbert Aptheker, The Book of Negro Folklore by Hughes and Bond Thompson, of course, most importantly, The Negro Caravan by Sterling Brown, Arthur Davis, and Ulysses Lee. Sterling Stuckey, a leading advocate and scholar of black history for over a decade, summarized these new insights into slavery as follows. Slave folklore, then, affirms the existence of a large number of vital, tough-minded human beings who, though severely limited and abused by slavery, had found a way both to endure and preserve their humanity in the face of insuperable odds. What they learned about handling misfortune was not only a major factor in their survival as a people, but many of the lessons learned and aesthetic standards established would be used by future generations of Afro-Americans in coping with a hostile world. What a splendid affirmation of the hopes and dreams of their slave ancestors that some of the songs being sung in the antebellum days were the same ones Afro-Americans sang in the freedom movement. Michael, row the boat ashore, or just like a tree planted by the water, I shall not be moved. Hopefully, with new understandings, curriculums will be written for our schools, which will honestly integrate the black experience into American history and culture, and hopefully honestly teach a course in Afro-American culture. But this rewriting must include, in addition to a revision of our concept of slavery, a proper treatment of the other side of the story, that is, white racism. By this I mean, we must tell the reasons why Old Master needed to oppress and dehumanize black Americans. As the black man emerged from Reconstruction with psychological and physical scars added to those already suffered during slavery's days, so also emerged new black expressions, the work and prison songs, folk ballads, and the blues. However, if we've been teaching the history of this era of Reconstruction and post-Reconstruction as though race relationships were progressing in a harmony dominated by none other than Booker T. Washington, it will be difficult to give meaning to the blues. For freedmen who felt the catastrophe of the South's new techniques of debasement and violence by the turn of the 20th century, these lyrics expressed the agony and bitterness, but most importantly, they expressed a continued determination to survive. Kenneth Stamp and others in a study completed 4 years ago of textbooks used in the California public schools recommends that always and everywhere, our children should be told the truth and the whole truth, as near as the best current scholarship can bring us to this elusive quality. This means, among other things, not obscuring the harsher aspects of the truth. My approach to teaching this aspect of Afro-American history at the turn of the 20th century has been to use two recordings, two songs by two black folks, Leon Bibb and Billie Holiday. Leon Bibb sings the following. Take this hammer and carry it to the captain. Tell him I'm gone. You tell him I'm gone. If he asks you, Was I running? You tell him I was flying. You tell him I was flying. If he asks you, was I laughing? You tell him I was crying. You tell him I was crying. And Billie Holiday sings, Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the roots. Black body swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scenes of the gallant South, bulging eyes and a twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia sweet and fresh, then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is the fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the trees to drop. Here is the strange and bitter crop. Claude McKay, a black poet of the Harlem Renaissance period, took up Billie Holiday's cry, but he elaborated upon the lynchers when he wrote these lines at the end of his poem entitled The Lynching. Day dawned, and soon the mixed crowds came to view the ghastly body swinging in the sun. The women thronged to look, but never a one showed sorrow in her eyes of steely blue. And little lads, lynchers that were to be, danced round the dreadful thing in fiendish glee. It's no wonder, as we wander through the years of the Harlem Renaissance, that its black men and women reached boldly back to their folk heritage to dispel the white man's version of their cultural and historical existence. Langston Hughes protested against white America in many ways and for numerous reasons. His tales of simple are simple only for those who do not understand. All too often, the black experience is reinterpreted and revised by white writers until it is simply no longer recognizable. The original folk expression is lost, and with the credit to the black man. Langston Hughes expressed this situation in the following manner over 40 years ago. You've taken my blues and gone. You sing them on Broadway, and you sing them in Hollywood Ball, and you mix them up with symphony, and you fix them so they don't sound like me. Yep, you've done taken my blues and gone. You also took my spirituals and gone. You put them in Macbeth and Carmen Jones and all kind of swing mikados and in everything but what's about me. But someday, somebody will stand up and talk about me and write about me, black and beautiful, and sing about me and put on plays about me. I reckon it'll be me myself. Yes, it'll be me. That black and beautiful was 40 years ago. The migration of nearly 2 million black folk from the rural South to the urban North from the turn of the century through World War I must be considered a major development in the cultural history of Afro-Americans. Harlem, a city which doubled its population during these decades, would provide the setting for new experiences as well as the reevaluations of the past. Black people in such close contact could now share reactions, find mutual motivation, and thus create a cultural and intellectual center. Du Bois' talented 10th would become a reality in this young generation, faced daily with the gap between the promises and the experiences of freedom. One must, however, if teaching the period of the 20s, trace the cultural works of the Harlem Renaissance back to the spirit of the earlier times. By this I mean the spirit of the resolutions and demands of the men of the Niagara Movement of 1905. Back to the spirit of Du Bois' litany at Atlanta, written following a brutal race riot in that city in 1906. And then back to the founding of the NAACP and the Urban League and their magazines, The Crisis and The Opportunity, in their early days. Furthermore, If teaching this aspect, the Black Renaissance, it must be remembered, coincided with a general poetic rebirth in America about 1912. Alain Locke, a Rhodes Scholar and Howard University professor, published an anthology of the works of these young Black writers in 1925, which he entitled The New Negro. Their expressions thusly became known as the New Negro Movement. But I'm suggesting, and I guess warning, that the teacher must be careful with the use of this term. Today, of course, careful that we now remember that was called the New Negro Movement. But more than this, we so often think of the New Negro of the 20s and forget the earlier generations of Black people and the many ways in which they expressed their resistance and continued resistance to slavery and its aftermath. The New Negro of the 1920s felt a fresh independence from the propaganda of white America. The urban setting and the sense of group feeling created a mood in which the Black writer and artist turned toward his own Black brothers and sisters and declared a pride in himself, Black and beautiful. Langston Hughes expressed, perhaps the best, the race-proud writers of the Harlem Renaissance when he wrote the following in 1926. We younger Negro artists who create now intend to express our individual dark-skinned selves without fear or shame. If white people are pleased, we are glad. If they are not, it doesn't matter. We know we are beautiful and ugly, too. The tom-tom cries and the tom-tom laughs. If colored people are pleased, we are glad. If they are not, their displeasure doesn't matter either. We build our temples for tomorrow, strong as we know how, and stand on top of the mountain, free within ourselves. That was 1926. The leading poets of this period were men such as Claude McKay, Jean Toomer, Langston Hughes, County Cullen, James Weldon Johnson, and Sterling Brown. Claude McKay came to New York from his home in Jamaica in 1912 when he was just 23 years old. His book of verse entitled Harlem Shadows, appearing in 1922, made him a major writer of this period. In 1928, his first novel, Home to Harlem, increased his popularity. The race consciousness and militant anger at white America during this period can be heard in the following poem by Claude McKay, entitled To the White Fiends. Think you I am not fiend and savage too? Think you I could not arm me with a gun and shoot down 10 of you for every one of my Black brothers murdered, burnt by you? Be not deceived. For every deed you do, I could match, outmatch. Am I not Afric's son? Black of the black land where black deeds are done. But the Almighty from the darkness drew my soul and said, even thou shalt be a light a while to burn on the benighted earth. Thy dusky face I set among the white for thee to prove thyself of higher worth. Before the world is swallowed up in night to show thy little lamp, go forth, go forth. If there is any one man, to my mind, who expresses the black contributions to America during the first half of the 20th century, it is a man we've long forgotten, named Paul Robeson. I contend that if Mr. Robeson had been white, he would have been hailed as America's great Renaissance man, perhaps our own Leonardo da Vinci. But a black man, in order to be equal then and now, had to excel, and this he did. A Phi Beta Kappa from Rutgers with 12 letters in sports, a law degree from Columbia, and an All-American end in football. The world of the stage during the Black Renaissance saw Robeson's debut at the Harlem YWCA. 4 years later, in 1924, he starred in O'Neill's All God's Children Got Wings. This star actor later established the all-time record of the longest run of any Shakespearean plays, with 296 performances of Othello. Freedom Ways magazine honored Paul Robeson on his return to New York. In the program notes of April 22, 1965, we can share the inspiration which this man gave to countless black and hopefully white Americans when they wrote, "There is no such thing as a non-controversial black man in this geographical spot where America is a synonym for whiteness. To be born here is to be born into danger and controversy. Paul Robeson chose to be a man in despite of all which naysayed him in his political paradox. In this exercise, he has outraged many while sending others scurrying under the delusions of their collective inanities. But to most of us, Paul Robeson has grown in majesty and saintliness. Yes, saintliness, for saints are those whom the collective will of the people canonize." With regard to the Afro-American musical tradition of this era, Leroy Jones, in his book, The Blues People, states that when jazz first began to appear during the 20s on the American scene, it was introduced in a great many instances by white Americans. Jazz, as it was originally conceived, was the result of certain attitudes attributable to Afro-American culture. Jazz as played by white musicians was not the same as that played by black musicians, nor was there any reason for it to be. The music of the white musician did not issue from the same cultural circumstances. It was a learned art. The blues, for example, which I take to be an autonomous black music, had very little weight at all in the pre-jazz white American culture. But blues is an extremely important part of jazz. Jones uses Bix Beiderbecke and Louis Armstrong as examples and states that Beiderbecke, that white middle-class boy from Iowa, was the product of a culture which could place Louis Armstrong but could never understand him. On the other hand, Armstrong was one of the most impressive products of his society. He was not rebelling against anything in his music. In fact, his music was one of the most beautiful refinements of Afro-American musical tradition, and it was immediately recognized as such by those Negroes who were not busy trying to pretend that they had issued from Beiderbecke's culture. The point is that Afro-American music did not become a completely American expression until the white man could play it. And Jones continues that by the late 20s, there were quite a few very good jazz bands all over the country, and competent musicians appeared everywhere from 1920 on. By 1930, every city outside of the Deep South with a Negro population above 60,000, except Philadelphia, had produced an important band. Washington produced Duke Ellington, Baltimore, Chick Webb, Memphis, Jimmy Lunsford, Chicago, Louis Russell and Armstrong, New York, Fletcher Henderson, Charlie Johnson, and half a dozen more. Of the blues-oriented bands of the 30s and early 40s, Count Basie's had the most profound effect on the young musicians of the 40s, who would soon be called boppers. The Basie Band was in the hard, swinging southwestern blues tradition and was certainly less polished than the beautiful Ellington groups of the late 30s and early 40s. But Basie's music offered a fresh, open method for contemporary reinterpretation of that important Afro-American musical tradition. My first realistic confrontation with the manner in which Afro-American music had been omitted and distorted in our traditional teaching came the day a black high school student, and a jazz musician, returned to me his American history textbook. He had discovered that the history of jazz was attributed in his book to Paul Whiteman. Perhaps this young man, now graduating from college, is a part of that great black students' movement on someone's campus. The second wave of literary expressions in the 20th century followed the Depression of the 30s. This ill wave, however, brought the blessings of the Federal Writers Project, which employed such black authors as Claude McKay, Arna Bontemps, Zora Neale Hurston, Chester Himes, Richard Wright, Anne Sterling Brown serving as an advisor. Some of the major American writing of the 1940s and 50s was that of Afro-Americans, Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison. Wright's Native Son marked the first black protest novel against the tragedy of American living, urban living, an experience felt by millions of black people subject to America's racism. Wright's major contemporary in racial protest was Chester Himes, whose If He Hollers, Let Him Go was published in 1945. The post-war years, however, also saw Afro-American literature which was not concerned with protest. Robert Bone, in The Negro Novel in America, groups the novel of these years into three possibilities. The escapist literature, that is, pulp fiction as a commercial venture, such as Frank Yerby's The Foxes of Harrow. Those which avoid conflict by avoiding Negro life, such as Motley's Knock on Any Door. And thirdly, those which deal with race material, but not necessarily with racial conflict, such as Dodson's Boy at the Window or West, The Living is Easy. You have to realize which one you've been using in your teaching. Considered by recent surveys to be the best American novel during the period from World War II to the 60s, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man is described by Sterling Brown as a wonderful series of vignettes, rich in farce, comedy, irony, satire, melodrama, tragedy, and grotesquerie, all set solidly in the Negro experience. One of Ellison's triumphs is that it will be hard for cardboard heroes and villains to occupy the fictional stage any longer. An understanding of Baldwin, Killens, Kelly, Williams, and others will provide an answer to Professor Brown's prophecy. The black poets, following the Depression days and influenced by their Renaissance forerunners, would include among the better known Margaret Walker and Gwendolyn Brooks, Melvin Tolson and Robert Hayden. Only a few years ago, a new book appeared entitled New Negro Poets, USA. Pulitzer Prize winner Gwendolyn Brooks captured the situation in which many Afro-American poets find themselves when she stated the following in the introduction to this book. At the present time, poets who happen also to be Negroes are twice tried. They have to write poetry, and they have to remember that they are Negroes. They are likely to find significance in those subjects not instantly obvious to their fairer fellows. The raindrop may seem to them to represent racial tears. The golden sun might remind them that they are burning. If there is a lesson to be learned from a survey of Afro-American culture, it is the obvious fact, not often realized by most educators, that we cannot simply make changes in the course structure and write new curriculum guides. We must simultaneously seek creative ways to sensitize teachers to the need for change, given the nature of racial attitudes and prejudices. Such an essential sensitivity to black bards as well as black historians might find a beginning in planned in-service workshops and programs dealing not only with Afro-American culture and history, but also with the history of anti-Negro attitudes and actions called racism.